Today is Friday, June 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A new UN report warns of increased Taliban activity in Afghanistan.
The Taliban, quote, believes that it can achieve almost all of its objectives by negotiation or, if by necessary, by force, according to the report.
Plus, VOA visits an internally displaced persons camp in Tigray.
The situation is pretty bad.
And a look at how one city is using technology to help the visually impaired. We'll have these stories and more next. In a new United Nations report, the global organization warns the Taliban is increasing its military posture in Afghanistan. The study comes as the United States continues to draw down from the country and conclude its nearly two decades of conflict. Earlier, I spoke with VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden about what the report indicated and what may manifest in the months to come.
Well, the UN report, based on the intelligence from member states, basically affirms a lot of what we've been hearing from U.S. intelligence and other agencies in the last couple of months about what's going on with the Taliban, and that is that they've ramped up attacks in some areas against Afghan government forces, that they've strengthened their grip on parts of the country, for example, in northern Afghanistan, where they've really clamped down and control many of the roadways and the travel ways there to the extent that they haven't since, according to the UN report, since 2001. And that they've positioned their fighters in ways around district centers, provincial capitals across the country that they, at worst, have leverage. And in some scenarios, if they feel they're not getting what they want at the negotiating table, that they can use military force and take it. The assessment from the UN basically boils down to, according to the report, that the Taliban, quote, believes that it can achieve almost all of its objectives by negotiation or, if by necessary, by force, according to the report.
Does the report indicate where things may be headed for in the future?
The report from the UN, which again is based on the intelligence from UN member states, suggests that the Taliban are at least willing to give it a try at the negotiating table. But there are questions as to how committed the Taliban are and Taliban leadership is towards negotiations, towards a peaceful resolution of decades of conflict in Afghanistan. The report says that it's unclear what the Taliban leader thinks of all of this. And it notes that two of his top deputies, including one who's had control over the Haqqani network, which is kind of an army within an army for the Taliban, if you will, oppose peace talks and favor settling this by military force. And they've got the numbers to potentially do that. The intelligence agencies estimate that the Taliban have anywhere from 58,000 to 100,000 fighters. That's a number that's remained pretty consistent. There's been some attrition, but the Taliban have also been taking some of their forces and placing them in reserve and not having them in active situations across the country. And they can bring a pretty big force there. They also have units that are highly skilled when it comes to complex attacks or building IEDs, improvised explosive devices, or rockets. And again, there's a concern that the Afghan government forces are simply not going to be able to withstand Taliban attacks without the support of U.S. advisors on the ground and without the easy access to air support from the U.S. and the coalition in the form of airstrikes. And already the situation on the ground seems to favor the Taliban, according to U.N. intelligence that's, again, gleaned from members. The Taliban control about 57% of district administrative centers. And when you take a step back and you look at the countryside, the Taliban, according to the report, contests or controls anywhere from 50 to 70% of territory outside urban centers. So there's a strong grip there. And it really seems to suggest, based on the intelligence from what the report is saying and from what other intelligence agencies, including the DIA, are saying, that if the Taliban choose, they can use force and achieve probably most of their aims.
Has the Pentagon, the State Department, or the White House commented on this report?
Pentagon officials have not commented publicly on the report itself. The State Department responded to the report. The spokesman, Ned Price, told reporters that the only way to what he called a just and durable political settlement is at the negotiating table.
Jeff Zeldin is VOA's national security correspondent. The more than 6 months of fighting has ravaged Ethiopia's Tigray region. And according to the United Nations, at least two of the region's 6 million people have been displaced, and all sides in the conflict have been accused of committing human rights abuses. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken even went as far as to say that the actions taking place in the Tigray region are a form of ethnic cleansing, as fighting between the Tigray People's Liberation Front, Ethiopian and Eritrean forces continue. The United Nations says that 91% of the people living in the area are in dire need of emergency food assistance. VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul Bureau Chief Heather Murdoch recently arrived in Ethiopia and on Thursday visited an internal displacement camp in the regional capital of Mekele. She shared with me what she saw.
They estimate that there's about 200,000 people displaced in Mekele, the capital of the region, alone. And most of the displaced are outside. But we went to visit a camp today of about a little more than 7,000 people, and it's one of 26 camps in the city. And the situation is, it's pretty dire. It's not as dire as the stories they tell about where they came from, but there's very little humanitarian aid, even here in the capital where there is access. The people we spoke to today, almost all of them, including the children, had not eaten. Before 2 p.m., no food had arrived. There's a shelter, but it's very, very crowded. It was a schoolhouse, and in one room, about, say, 10 meters by 6 meters, 82 people were sleeping. And that was sort of the average of how many people were in the space. And this is one of the newer camps. A lot of the camps aren't accepting anybody because they're just completely packed, and they're hoping they'll build more because it's still coming. And this camp wants to stop accepting people because they're so crowded and there's so little resources. But there's nothing to be done about the fact that people are still fleeing the region for the capital.
Heather, have you been able to speak to any government officials or any NGO administrators about the need for humanitarian assistance, not only in the capital, but throughout the region, since so many people are in dire need?
Yes. We have spoke to some people about this, and especially we spoke to the head of the camp that we were visiting today, although he was a displaced person himself. He was not an official outside organization. It is well understood that people outside of the region controlled directly by the Ethiopian government is pretty much cut off from humanitarian aid, from access to journalists as well. And there's great fears that a famine is already beginning or is coming, and there's certainly food insecurity even in the safest parts of this region. So in the least safe parts of the region, it's assumed that the situation is not only terrible now, but getting worse very rapidly.
Heather, I want to go back to something you mentioned just a moment ago. You mentioned that in speaking with some of the individuals in the camps, they said that while the situation in the internally displaced camps is bad, where they came from, where they fled from, was worse. Were they able to recount any of the stories that you could share with our international listeners?
Yeah, I spoke to several people today who shared with me why and how they fled their homes. And, for example, I spoke to one woman who had a baby in her arms who was injured visibly. His arm cannot bend and it is burnt and cracked with blood. A couple of months ago, she fled her home when the war suddenly broke out. She was at the marketplace shopping on a Saturday, and suddenly soldiers rolled into town and gunfire began. She ran home. She told her sister, who was making coffee at the time, that we had to run, and she and her children and her sister just fled their houses on foot. And then spent several weeks running or hiding in from village to village, hiding from soldiers. They were talking about Eritrean soldiers. They were specifically in their area. But as you said, there are other military groups involved in the fight, and so it just depends where they're coming from. So they were running from Eritrean soldiers or fights between the Eritrean soldiers and the local, the TPLF, the Tigray fighters that are still in the area, but outside of the community. And then she made her way finally to Mekelle, even though she had to escape because they told her she couldn't leave. And in Mekelle, she finally got to a doctor after about a couple of months on the run. And the doctor said she was too late and said, the doctor said, where have you been? You know, you're too late. This child could have had an operation to fix his arm, but now he's crippled. And she was heartbroken and also terrified that she's never going to be able to go home and scared to stay where she is. But like, as I said before, she was one of the many people to today who by mid-afternoon hadn't had a single bite to eat and had no way of getting food unless somebody shows up to bring it for her.
Heather, what about the capital itself, Melike?
I guess the one thing I could add about my initial reporting, because it's kind of new here, is that this city is also, even though it's the most open and safe city in the region, incredibly expensive. There's a curfew at 9 to 6 o'clock. There's electricity often doesn't work. Internet only works in like a couple of spots. They say it works in the Kelly, but it works in like two hotels and NGO offices. And even then, it doesn't work very well. So it's disconnected. People are scared and very tense.
Heather Murdoch is VOA's Middle East correspondent, as well as its Istanbul bureau chief. She was speaking to me from Melike, Tigray. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A recent study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies showed that Russia has bolstered its influence in Africa in recent years by playing the cards it has well, employing a combination of mercenary and disinformation interventions in support of isolated African leaders or proxies. According to that report, Russia has had the most influence in Libya, Central African Republic, Sudan, Madagascar, Mozambique, and Mali. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Joseph Siegel, the author of the study, about the weak points in Africa that encouraged Russia to expand its influence and pursue its strategic goals on the continent.
Russia's use of mercenaries is a distinctive feature of its foreign policy in Africa. And this, along with its, you know, different disinformation campaigns, its armed for resources deals, violations of armed embargoes, election meddling, all of which Russia denies, of course, are particularly destabilizing for Africa. And, you know, Russia is able to do this because Africa provides an easy and attractive theater where Russia can advance its interests. And, you know, it does this by working with isolated African leaders who benefit from Russia's interventions in weak states, places that are unable to verify or block Russia's often opaque activities, or that would enable the public to push back against the complicity of its leaders. And Russia's bearing few reputational or financial costs for the instability that it's fomenting on the continent. And, you know, the result in Africa is a reduced level of national sovereignty and a reduced level of agency for African citizens.
So what are the Russian strategic goals in the African continent?
The first is that Russia seems to be making a very strong play to gain influence in Northeast Africa, particularly Libya, where it would like to be able to control and gain access to a number of the ports and oil reserves, both on and offshore. This would give it influence in the Eastern Mediterranean, which holds both the natural resource potential, but also is a main chokehold through the Suez Canal. This, of course, is on the southern front of Europe. And so it's a very strategic location. And Russia has also been engaging significantly in Egypt and Algeria. I think the second point I would emphasize is the interest in naval bases in the Red Sea. We have seen Russia make a concerted effort to set up agreements with Sudan and Port Sudan. They've been talking to Somaliland regarding access to the Port of Berbera, talking to Eritreans about Massawa and Eritrea. And so, again, doing so would give Russia access to an important trade routes and naval passageways, including through the Bab al-Mandab off of Djibouti and Yemen. I think a third area of strategic interest for Russia is that it is trying to gain outsized influence in a number of targeted African countries, and it's doing this through relationships establishing with some 8 to 12 isolated, mostly autocratic leaders on the continent, especially those who have access to natural resources or strategic importance geographically. And by forming these personalized relationships, Russia is able to affect much greater influence in these countries than it would with a more conventional foreign policy strategy. The final objective is that Russia is trying to reshape the governance norms on continent and as part of a broader effort internationally to undermine the perception of the viability of democracy, and in so doing to negate the effectiveness of a rules-based international system.
So what are the basic non-military tools Russia used to achieve its strategic goals in Africa?
In addition to these unconventional measures, Russia does have some traditional sorts of foreign policy initiatives on the continent. These involve trade, most of which, though, are for arms, for resources types of deals. Russia is the supplier of half of all the arms that come into Africa. But Russia has an educational program in Africa. It supports somewhere around 15,000 African university students studying in Russia every year. Russia has been investing heavily in nuclear power technology, and most advanced of these initiatives is in Egypt. There are plans to build a $60 billion nuclear power plant in Egypt, and Russia has already provided a $25 billion loan to the Egyptians to start the construction on this. But beyond Egypt, Russia is negotiating with 17 other African countries and has preliminary deals in the works with several others, including Ethiopia, Rwanda, Zambia, and Sudan. Finally, Russia is working through the UN Security Council Africa member. So Africa has three rotating members of the UN Security Council called the A3, and Russia focuses heavily on those three as a way of trying to leverage its influence on global issues.
That was Joseph Siegel of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. On Thursday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fought back against an agreement by his political opponents for a government of left-wing, centrist, and right-wing parties aimed at unseating him. Reuters' Megan Revelle is up next.
Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, is on the verge of being toppled from power after more than a decade in office. From ultranationalists to Arab-Israeli Islamists, the right-winger is set to be ousted by an extremely fragile and unlikely alliance of parties from across the political spectrum who have little in common other than their desire to break a political deadlock that saw four elections in 2 years. The coalition all hinges on an unlikely figure, Mansour Abbas, head of the United Arab List. The inclusion of his tiny Islamist faction was crucial in securing a paper-thin majority for the coalition, which would be the first in Israel's history to represent its 21% Arab minority. A dentist by profession, Abbas said he has put differences aside for a chance to improve conditions for Arab citizens who report discrimination and government neglect. His inclusion stands in stark contrast to the head of the New Guard, Naftali Bennett, leader of the ultra-nationalist party Yamina, or Rightwards.
So we'll get once and for all a government who actually cares for the people.
Bennett is a former leader of a major Jewish settlement organization and an advocate of annexing most of the occupied West Bank. His religious pro-settler party won only 7 of the Knesset's 120 seats in the March election. But Bennett emerged first as kingmaker, then kingslayer, and now king. Under the deal, the former defense minister and high-tech millionaire would become prime minister before handing over the post in 2 years to centrist Yair Lapid. Lapid is a former TV host and finance minister who heads up Yesh Atid.
Shalom lachem.
The center-left party came second in the latest election with 17 seats. Sources say the hopeful government would initially avoid hot-button ideological issues. Parliamentary approval is still pending, and analysts say Netanyahu will try and pick off, quote, low-hanging fruit, trying to convince right-wingers to jump ship, who are unhappy about teaming up with Arab and leftist lawmakers.
Megan Revelle reports for Reuters News. On Thursday, the United States says that it has a plan to share 25 million coronavirus vaccines with the world.
We're sharing them in a wide range of countries within Latin America and the Caribbean, South and Southeast Asia, and across Africa in coordination with the African Union.
That's White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
Our approach also prioritizes South and Southeast Asia, including countries like India, Nepal, the Philippines, and others that are undergoing surges right now, including countries with low vaccination rates or dealing with urgent present crises, like the West Bank and Gaza, Ukraine, Kosovo, Iraq, Haiti, and others.
Sullivan made the remarks during a coronavirus task force press conference and noted that the United States would share the vaccines without political consideration. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Cities around the world are installing new technology that connects to the personal devices of pedestrians, drivers, and riders on public transportation. Some cities are using these systems to make transportation easier for people with disabilities, such as those who are blind. Jason Strother has that story.
Park Hyung-bae doesn't leave home much without help from his mother or another guide. The 32-year-old says navigating Busan's public transportation isn't comfortable for someone who is blind. When I've traveled without my family or someone to guide me, I've gotten lost and asked people where I am, Park says. But sometimes they just ignore me, and I have no idea if they've walked away or not. It makes me feel isolated. It's hard to ask for help, he says. But new smart technology inside a Busan metro station could help people with visual impairments travel more independently. Park is trying out a new smartphone app called Tagati Naranhi, or Side by Side. It locates users with GPS and provides meter-by-meter directions to station amenities. Park uses his phone's text-to-speech software to listen to the directions. It tells him to walk straight for 98 meters. He arrives at one of two accessible information kiosks that's connected to Bluetooth beacons placed all around the station. The system speaks out loud and has a braille touchpad that turns into a tactile map of the facility. Park says when he selects a destination, the braille display lets him feel the layout of the station and he can memorize where he needs to go. So far, the new tech is just in one subway station, but city officials say they plan to expand the app's coverage and install kiosks in all of the metro's 114 stations. John Byung-jun is with the Busan Transportation Corporation. He says this technology is not just for people with disabilities. It can be convenient for pregnant women and the elderly. It has multiple languages, so even foreign visitors can use it. It's for everyone, John adds. Smart technology can benefit everyone if it's made with universal design. That's according to the Seoul-based firm Dot, which partnered with Busan and built the accessible kiosk. Go Mi-suk, who handles customer service, says one way to do that is to bring more people who are blind to the table. She says from her perspective, as someone with a visual disability, there's a difference in how people without a disability think about making products that can be used by someone who is blind. Go says that's why it's important that visually impaired people be part of the planning and design process. Back at the Busan metro station, Park Hyung-bae says that inclusive tech does not just improve mobility. Non-disabled people don't often see people with a disability using the subway, he says. If this technology makes it easier for us to use public transportation, I think the overall perception of people with disabilities will improve. And that, he adds, will bring down social barriers. Jason Strother for VOA News, Busan, South Korea.
And finally, the world's oceans, once viewed as too big to deplete or destroy, are in crisis. There are many reasons for this: human-caused climate change, overfishing, illegal fishing, pollution, and many other factors. There are also horrific crimes committed against workers in the high seas, much of which are outside the specific legal jurisdiction of any one country to police and beyond the political will of many policymakers to correct. The vast intersection of ocean environmentalism, labor, and human rights are the subject of a new book, Outlaw Ocean, Journeys Across the Last Untamed Frontier by Ian Urbana. Urbana is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who has spent the last 7 years reporting for the likes of the New York Times, the New Yorker magazine, and the Outlaw Ocean Project, the nonprofit he formed to shed light on the wild and watery frontier most will never see or explore. Urbana spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
You know, the two-thirds of the planet that's water is this realm that rarely gets covered journalistically, and it's existentially important to the planet, but also 50 million people work out there. And for all of these reasons, we try to tell stories about human rights, labor, and environmental abuses that are occurring offshore.
That's a lot of so-called ground to cover.
Yeah, I mean, the nature of the space, it's sprawling and hard to police. The high seas in particular are jurisdictionally complicated. It belongs to everyone and no one, so no government really takes responsibility. The nature of the people that work in the space are often migrant, trafficked, undocumented labor from developing nations. For all these reasons, abuses are more common and often occur with impunity, since there's very little investigation or prosecution happening about the crimes out there.
Who are the main victims of those crimes?
The foremost victim of crimes out there is the ocean itself, and the crimes range from intentional dumping to unfettered, unregulated mining. More than 80% of the world's fish stocks are at or beyond the point of collapse. They've been overfished. You also have a rampant problem of illegal fishing. One in five fish that end up on the average person's plate comes off of a pirate vessel. By 2050, some research says there'll be more plastic in the ocean than fish. So the state of affairs at sea are pretty bleak.
Then there's the horrific human element. As just one example in your book, you describe a foot wound on a crew member aboard an illegal Chinese fishing vessel. The guy's foot had been cut by a catfish whisker.
His foot got extremely infected, and when we boarded the vessel to inspect it for other crimes, he kind of came out of the woodwork and showed us his foot. It was so swollen and the skin so tight, it looked like a oozing eggplant. We had a doctor come on board and try to dress the wound, but the guy didn't have any footwear to keep that foot dry, and he was just going to go back to work, so that gauze and such would just, you know, soak in the nasty detritus that lines the fish deck anyway.
Was he there of his own free will? I know a great many workers have been kidnapped or enslaved.
No, those guys, from what I could tell, were not debt bonded or shanghaied, or they're making woefully low wages. It's pretty shocking, but most of them have a contract of sorts, and they're working, you know, 2-3 month rotations, and then they go to shore. The living conditions on the boats were just abysmal, but they were not debt bonded, as you find, say, on the South China Sea.
Tell me about your Outlaw Ocean music project. I know that it partly helps pay for your investigative journalism and your nonprofit, which are very expensive to support.
It's this global effort that started a year ago where we recruit musicians, be they hip-hop, electronic, classical, folk, jazz. 80 different countries are presently involved. And they read the story and the book, and they figure out what of that reporting moves them. They choose the topics, and then they draw from sounds that we've collected in 7 years of reporting. So that might be machine gun fire in Somalia, or chanting Cambodian deckhands on the South China Sea. Interesting textured sounds that give you a sense of place. And the musicians attempt to integrate some of that sound into their song. And then we publish the albums.
So what is the underlying ambition for the Outlaw Music Project?
There are a bunch of ambitions. One, it's just a fun, creative collaboration between two types of storytellers, if you think of a musician as a storyteller. The second is to try to commandeer platforms that aren't traditionally news platforms. So Spotify, Pandora, Apple Play, YouTube. These are platforms that have huge audiences, younger audiences, global audiences that don't typically read what I'll write for the New York Times and the New Yorker magazine, but they might be interested. And then they get curious, what's that sound? Why is it called that? What's that imagery? And they click their way over often to the story and they read the full story. There's a lot happening to counter these problems, but the problems are acute.
Ian Urbana is the author of Outlaw Ocean, Journeys Across the Last Untamed Frontier, and he was speaking with Adam Phillips prior to his retirement last month. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.